Well, let's welcome back Manager Chris Coase. Chris, do you have any team updates for us?
The few things that of note, I guess, would be we're about to reactivate Braden Higgins from the injured list, and then we just recently signed Alex Crosby, who, if you're a fan of the league, you know him from Gary, so he'll jump in our lineup here the next time we play, and so, you know, we didn't feel like we needed to make a ton of moves, just maybe the right move to boost our offense a little bit, but getting Braden Higgins back, you know, at doing what he does. When he's right, he's as good a pitcher as our league has. So hopefully that's a nice boost for us as well.
That's awesome. Well, let's jump into fan questions, and we'll start off with Chris, who would like to know, why no games this weekend?
Well, it was a scheduling situation with our stadium. There was like a Blues Fest, and so they had to use our ballpark Friday and Saturday. They knew that well in advance, so that's why we had a couple scheduled doubleheaders throughout the season. So it's kind of weird to have a Friday and a Saturday off. You know, you do enjoy your off day on occasion, but with as many off days as we've already had this year, you know, having every Monday off, which is nice, didn't really want all these off days. And, of course, a rain out on Sunday as well. So, you know, as much as we do appreciate off days, probably too many off days for us in a shortened season. But, you know, that's what we deal with, and I guess we'll take it.
Chris would also like to know, how does that affect the hitters when you have so many days off in a row?
Sometimes it depends on what you've been doing lately. You know, our offense hasn't really hit its stride all season. We finally have probably one of our best games. You know, you take maybe our two or three best games, that was our best game, that last game in St. Paul. You know, so to have a couple off days, you know, it's not that we got hot. We had one really good game, but it was a situation where we kind of would have liked to just play right away just to see if we could carry some momentum, so now to start over. But, you know, Winnipeg is going to be in a similar boat. They, you know, they haven't played as great as they played against us, but I'm sure the way they played against us all year, they're looking forward to get back on the field against us. But, you know, we'll be a slightly different team. Once again, the addition of Alex Crosby and Braden Higgins will start the first game of a doubleheader. And, you know, so we feel pretty good about what we're doing. But at the same time, our guys, and with what's left of the season, we've got to play our best baseball on a nightly basis from here on out.
Mark would like to know, do you think having a little mini break like this is actually good to help the team get recharged?
Yeah, it's possible. That's the way that we have to look at it, because we really haven't found ourselves yet this year. On paper, I think every time you and I have talked, I talk about, like, on paper we look like this, and that's true, but we really haven't hit our stride. We really haven't discovered what kind of ability our team has at this stage, which 30 games in, you'd think we'd have a pretty good idea. But so maybe this little break, we start up again, you know, against Winnipeg, doubleheader, and then a couple other single 9-inning games, that it maybe feels like the start of a new season. It's one of those situations where we joke now that since we had a pretty rough first half, we wish there was halves, like a second half title be shooting for it, because once again, we do really feel good about the team that we have on paper. We just have to start playing that way.
Zach says, Rob gave the team a C at the midpoint. How do you believe the team has performed to this point?
It depends how you look at it. C might even be somewhat generous, because we've underachieved. We're a team that should be right in the thick of it between our starting rotation. But we've been a different team seemingly every week. We started out where our starting rotation wasn't going very deep in the games and putting a lot of pressure on our bullpen, and our bullpen was doing okay. Offensively, we were hanging in there. Then all of a sudden, our starting pitching is as good as the league has, but our bullpen has struggled just a little bit, and our offense has struggled. So it's just we're inconsistent. So to give us a C, I guess we'll take it. You know, there's weeks where we probably felt worse than that. There's weeks where we felt better than that. So we are to say we're average may be a compliment, but once again, we know what we're capable of. Now we just got to study for those tests a little bit more and do our homework and do better on those term papers, and we'll get that A that we're shooting for.
Spoken like a college professor there. That's awesome. Andy would like to know, what have you learned in the first 30 games of managing at the professional level?
Well, it's tough to say that I've learned anything new. I mean, you see things, and when you're a part of the decision-making process, whether it's relievers or, you know, batting order, things like that, it's just more affirmation that, you know, you get the guys ready, you give them information, you really have to rely on them to be ready, you know, and succeed and things like that. And there's been some really tough bullpen decisions to make, but it's what we're dealing with. Because once again, when we started the year, our bullpen maybe wasn't fully ready, and we asked a lot out of them, and then we got them some rest. So, you know, what I've learned is you're really, you know, building the team is incredibly important, but having guys ready, it's always that X factor of independent baseball from the year. And, you know, if you look at the managers and organizations that continuously have success, the common theme is they find players, ball players who are ready to go, perform, succeed, play their best. If they have players get signed, they fill those holes with equal or better players. You know, that's really so much of what this league is. I know in Fargo we've created a great environment for our players. You know, it's been tough because we've had more releases this year than maybe what we had expected or wanted. And when guys leave Fargo, you know, they're disappointed, they're sad that they want to be here. Now we need to create an environment of winning. So it's basically the thing that I've got to learn is making sure every single day there's that fire, there's that desire that, you know, in a shortened season, we need to bring it every single day like it's a playoff atmosphere. And that's what our guys kind of feel from this point on is it's not 100 games, not 144 games. We basically have less than 30 games left every game for us. Not that we got to win 30 games because that's just not possible, but we do need, in fact, first pitch of the game needs to feel like a playoff game every game.
He would also like to know, is it different in how you view the game when you are a coach or even when you were coaching at the college level than what you view it as a manager?
Yeah, well, you know, when you're a baseball guy, you see so many different things. You know, whether it's the pitching, hitting, whatever else. But when you're a coach and you specialize in a certain part of the game, like the last couple years as the bench coach or hitting coach, I ran the offense, and either Michael Slack or Jim Banigan ran the pitching staff, and we worked so incredibly well together. And even though, yeah, as a coach, I could influence some of the pitching, it wasn't my job. I had two guys that worked with pitchers just fantastic, and Michael Slack and Jim Bennett. And now as a manager, it encompasses every single thing, and every decision actually has an impact because you're no longer giving suggestions. You're actually making decisions. It was when I became a college head coach, that one thing our athletic director told me, he's like, you're going to find out that it's a lot easier to make suggestions and much tougher to make decisions. And that's actually, it's totally true. And unfortunately, I have some amazing people around me, whether it be, you know, Anthony Renz, our players, our older veteran players, you know, Jeff Bittiger, who builds the team a lot behind the scenes, ownership, you know, fans, things like that. So it really helps regardless of what your role is, but especially if you're a manager or a head coach in college, you really have to surround yourselves with the right people.
Don says, boy, those Saints really seem to have our number late in games. What's up with that?
It's, you know, we had both the first two games. They were winnable games, and it was just a situation where our bullpen just couldn't hold them down. It was kind of like the playoffs of 2019 where winnable games, we had leads late, and those are the toughest situations. It's one thing to just lose games, but when you have a lead late and you lose it with your bullpen, you know, it has a lasting impact, you know, for the next night, for the next series, maybe for the next week, because you have a lead again the next couple nights, and, you know, you'll wonder, okay, what decisions to make. But it's just a situation where when we get leads like that, you know, you want to count on your bullpen, and you got to turn the ball over to them at some point because our starting pitching has done amazing. They've kept us in games and given us a chance to win every single night. That when they do their job and you turn it over to the bullpen, you know, they have to do their job as well. But just as importantly, our offense needs to do better on a consistent basis as well because we're putting a lot of pressure on our pitchers to keep our opponent below two runs, and that's just not feasible to win a championship or make a playoffs or even go on a winning streak when you're asking the pitchers to keep our opponents under two runs. Yes, on occasion you want your pitchers to keep them like that, but it's just not possible. We really need our offense to step up, and when we have the base loaded, nobody out, it's not just about one run. We've got to find the ways to have big innings. Now, the third game against St. Paul, we did that. Matt Tomshaw was amazing on the mound. He threw a complete game. but at the same time, our offense took some of the pressure off, and we need more games like that. So the combination of our bullpen needs to be better, but also our offense does as well. So that was the reasons why we weren't able to win those two games against St. Paul. You know, you're going to look at our bullpen and see that they give up some runs, but really our offense needs to step up and score more runs earlier to take the pressure off as well.
Jim returns from last week and says, you brought up some great points about using a relief pitcher to open up ball games. Why isn't that more of a commonly used practice?
I think it depends on what type of team you have. You know, it's early in the season, we had the type of personnel with Kale Kosho who could do it really well. And then, you know, he had some arm issues where he just couldn't do it on a regular basis. It's something that we think about on occasion, but now we kind of like where our starting rotation is at. Now that our starting rotation is stretched out, when it works so well for us early in the year, our starters were only going to go 4 or 5 innings, 6 at best, and now our starters are going 6, maybe 7, so it becomes less of an issue, especially once Tyler Wilson came off the injured list and inactive list with a true 8th, 9th inning guy along with Osnowitz and Brent Jones. And we need those three guys to pitch really well because I feel like with our starting rotation, we're going to have some leads into the 7th inning because our starting pitching is going to continue to be strong and durable. So when we have leads, Brent Jones, Tyler Wilson, and Mitchell Osnowitz need to knock those games out. And then, you know, you get a combination like Brett Helton and Ryan Flores and Thurston and other guys as well. So if it makes sense, we would absolutely do it, but we just feel like with our starting rotation the way it is now, it's less necessary. But it is something that we think about daily, so we'll continue to evaluate if it makes sense for us.
Conrad says, this is something I have always wondered, Chris. It always seems that teams want to match their ace against the opponent's ace. Wouldn't it make better sense to match them up against a little bit less quality starter so that you have more chance of winning?
That's a conversation that would be fun to have. You put two lawyers on each side and debate what is the strongest thing. But really, other than opening day, sometimes it just lines up that way. You know, you got opening day or you have a playoff situation. You really want your number one guy out there as soon as you can because that means that number one guy comes back again. You don't really want, if you have a true ace, if you have a Max Scherzer or a Garrett Cole, you want that guy out there the first day so he can also be back the 5th day and the 9th day and so on and so forth. So that's really part of it. And you certainly don't want to concede like, well, if they have their ace going, we're just going to try to, you know, concede and give up the game. Those are the games that championship teams find a way to win. So if you truly have what you feel is a championship level team, you're going to match your ace with their ace because that's the game that you know if you win that game, you have the edge. So really it's a little bit of that, but more so once again, if you have that good of a pitcher, you in a 7-game series or a 5-game series, you want that ace out there as many times as you can.
You know, I wonder too though, if you came to your ace and said, hey, we'd like to move you back just so you have a better chance to win, I would assume that guy's like, wait a minute, I'm going against their top guy.
Absolutely, or he would not be an ace. So it's certainly a fun conversation, and believe me, people think about it. It's just, it wouldn't make sense over the long term because, once again, if you have a true ace, you get that guy out there to help you win a game. That's what, you know, the aces are making more money. You get them out there to earn that money and help you win ball games, regardless if it's against their Max Scherzer or their Garrett Cole or things like that. They got to get out there and do their thing. And that's what they want to do, like you said.
Randall would like to know, what made you finally decide that it was time to hang up the cleats?
Well, for me, it was pretty simple. I was 37. I blew my elbow out right at the end of spring training, kind of throwing a ball down to second base. I popped my elbow, had a Tommy John. And so for me, it was really, really easy that, you know, my abilities had slowed down just a little bit. And even though I was a pretty good player, me being 2% less of a player, I was not going to be able to sustain a major league career at that point. And I was 37. So when I hurt my elbow, I knew immediately my career was over. It was a blessing. I far exceeded any expectations I had. You know, I was not only able to get to the major leagues, but be on a World Series team, that it was really easy for me. But I love baseball so much that I continued to play Minnesota town ball up until I was, 46 years old, 45 years old. And if I wasn't with the Redhawks right now, I'd be playing town ball in Minnesota still. That's how much I love the game.
Ken would like to know, what are some tips you would give for young catchers to better handle a pitching staff?
Well, you have to do your homework and get to know your pitchers. You really need to catch a wide variety of pitchers. That's the other thing too. You gotta catch them bullpens. You gotta see them when they're at their best. You gotta see them at their worst. You gotta know what their weaknesses and strengths are. So getting to know your pitching staff, you know, it's one thing to be a physically gifted catcher, but you also have to be mentally tough and smart, quick learner, make adjustments, because once again, you have to get to know your pitching staff incredibly well. And that's, in my opinion, that's why Yadier Molina is so amazing. It's not just that he's so physically good behind the plate, because he, you know, with the arm, the blocking, the receiving, but he gets the most out of his pitchers. He's a leader. He knows what his pitchers can do. He doesn't ask them to make pitches that they can't do. He makes sure he recognizes everyone's strengths, weaknesses. So when a catcher is learning a pitching staff, you have to ask yourself all those questions. What can my pitcher do? What doesn't he do as well? If it's crunch time, what pitch do I want to be throwing? Things like that. So there's a lot that goes into catching more than just throwing the ball down to second. Unfortunately, throwing the ball down to second is what gets noticed the most. So sometimes that can be deceiving.
Nate says, I don't know if you remember this, Chris, but do you remember when Darren Dalton got hurt and Philadelphia fans cheered that? Are Phillies fans as ruthless as they are portrayed?
You know, I answer questions like this frequently, and all I can say is this. I was really, really lucky to be there during some really good times. I got there in 2006 when things were starting to look pretty strong. You know, Chase Utley was a young up-and-comer, Jimmy Rollins, Ryan Howard, Cole Hamels. And we had a great run at the end of 06. Then we win the Division 07, win the World Series in 08, lose the World Series in 09, and that was my career in Philadelphia. So I was really lucky to be there when things were great. And it's always been a little bit more of an Eagles town than a Phillies town, but I was there when that changed briefly. You know, we won a World Series in 08, and all of a sudden it became a Phillies town. And they still love their Eagles football, but we were able to take that at least for a little bit. So I wasn't there to experience, you know, the negativity that Philadelphia fans get. I was able to enjoy the best of times.
Jack returns and asks, you gave us your favorite ballparks last weekend, or last time. What parks didn't you like to play in?
It was a combination of, I would say, the old Washington RFK, I believe is what it was. Although we had some good times there, but it was, you know, it was an older football field that was made into baseball, but it worked. It was still major league, so there really wasn't much to complain about. Oddly enough, and I got to be careful how I say this, but as awesome as Wrigley Field is the first time you go, and even the second time, I think I played there six, maybe seven times. And each time you go, the luster wears off just a little bit. And I know there's at least two different times when we went there that they had just had concerts on the field, so the field conditions were maybe a little bit, you know, more rough than other ballparks. Obviously, there's only so much they could do with clubhouse because of physical logistics, and you can only renovate so much with what it is. You really appreciate the history and how amazing Wrigley Field is, but when you compare it to like the newer stadiums, you really get spoiled by those new ballparks, whether it was, you know, the new stadium when they built it in Philadelphia in the mid-2000s, and then the new Yankee Stadium in 2009 and all things like that. But really, it's hard for me to choose any specifically, because even Wrigley Field, the history is so amazing and it's still so beautiful that there's really very little to complain about, especially when you spend as much time in the minor leagues and playing winter ball in Mexico, Venezuela, Panama. The worst of the worst of the worst of major league stadiums, it's still major league baseball. Pretty awesome.
Renee would like to know, do you think your wife would say you are romantic?
Not really. You know, it's one of those things where my wife and I have been together since we were later in high school, you know, 16, 17 years old. And, you know, we're not only husband and wife, we are truly like best friends, to where sometimes that romanticism, you know, was gone a little bit. And I, you know, it's just kind of the way it is. So I'm not cold-hearted and I'm not a brick by any means, but at the same time, she would, if you asked her that question, she would laugh and say, no, not really.
Oh, now we have a tough question for you. Janet says, what would you say to a guy that you saw who just told his wife or girlfriend that she was fat? I mean, said it right to her face.
I would have to know more about what their relationship dynamics truly are, because, you know, every husband and wife relationship, there's a little bit difference or certain things. I can't imagine there's many husband and wife relationships that would go over very well anyways. I would be wondering if he had a bulletproof vest on, or if he was going to put a mask on from getting backhanded, things like that. So that would be one of those things where, you know, I'm not going to step in on someone else's relationship and whatever, but I'd also question the guy's sanity and also his future safety.
Always sleep with one eye open after that, boy. And we end with Ben, who says, baseball players are superstitious, and you even said you were to some degree, but how far does that go? Like, is there a Rick Forney voodoo doll in your office?
No, there's nothing quite like that. You know, the Red Hawks made a bobblehead of me a number of years ago, and I still have several, and every time my head falls off, I get nervous, and I get in my face. I'll call my chiropractor, be like, hey, my bobblehead head just fell off. I'm going to need a little neck adjustment, you know, things like that. And that's not a total joke either. I'm serious. There's times where my neck hurts from my bobblehead falling off, and I'll call my chiropractor before I even feel any pains in my neck. So, it's one of those things where when you get to the higher levels of your sport, everybody's so good, the coaching is so good, the managerial side is so strong that any edge you can get, even though you know that physical preparation, mental preparation, having good players is what's going to give your team success, you're still looking for any edge you can. So if there's a superstition that you think can help you out, you're certainly not going to give up on that. You don't want to rely on it, but at the same time, who are we to say that's not part of the deal either? So I've seen just too many cases of a superstition having an impact on people that you can't discount the power of some of those ridiculous superstitions.
So the Chris Coast bobblehead isn't in a glass encased enclosure to protect it?
No, I'm one of those guys that when I get something like that, whether it's of myself or somebody else, obviously if I had a Babe Ruth signed baseball, I would have that thing in glass and no one touch it. But I like things that are, you know, can be, you know, enjoyed, or like maybe it's a special baseball bat, and, you know, whether it's my family or friends, I'll let them hold it, things like that. So my bobblehead, I do get nervous because it's a common thing with that batch of bobbleheads that the neck is not overly stable. So that just makes me nervous when I see my head falling and rolling across the floor.
That's awesome. Thanks for joining us this week, Chris.
You got a good talk to me, Rob. We'll talk to you next week.